From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Suzette Gerlot is out of town this week, so I'll talk with Joshua Landis about airstrikes against the Islamic State and how Syria's neighbors are affected by millions of refugees.
All these countries, and particularly into smaller ones like Lebanon and Jordan, the economy is terrible. I know many people who've lost their jobs because Syrians are willing to do them for half the price.
Later, we'll broadcast Suzette's recent interview with Mia Kodo. Shortly after the country's independence from Portugal, the Mozambique Liberation Front asked him to suspend his medical studies and work as a journalist. Then civil war broke out.
It was 16 years where we are surrounded by, not just by the war, but what the kind of fear that is very ancient.
But now the news. This is World Views. I'm Rebecca Cruz, sitting in today for Suzette Gerlot. Well, Joshua Landis, thank you for joining us again today. A lot of news coming out of Syria. Perhaps the biggest news is that this week airstrikes by the United States looked to have gotten several high-ranking officials. And for a time, we thought that the leader, the caliph of the Islamic State, was injured, perhaps. But we hear yesterday that this is not the case, and he came out with a very interesting statement. What exactly did he say, and what are we to make of that?
Well, as you say, there were a lot of senior leaders of ISIS, the Islamic State, killed in a raid. And we're still trying to figure out exactly who was killed. But there was a lot of people thought that Baghdadi may have been killed. But on Thursday, the caliph issued a statement, clearly trying to make everybody understand that he was still alive, asking for the followers of the Islamic State around the world to erupt volcanoes of jihad across the world. And he particularly singled out Saudi Arabia, which has joined with the United States in these airstrikes, and claimed that Saudi Arabia is the head of a snake that's against the Islamic State, and he's asked his followers to cut it off. So
very stark images that he's providing us here, a volcano, the head of the snake, using his words very carefully.
Well, he must be a news junkie because he knows how to get quoted, that's for sure. So he's come up with this fiery speech saying that as long as there's one Islamic State fighter left alive, the battle will be on, that they will not cease to fight. But he's also had some good news this week because various radical groups in Libya, Egypt, and Yemen have all announced that they are aligning themselves to him and accept him as their caliph. So this is a battle that is far from over.
Well, so he's getting some followers. His message is clearly resonating. But even a little bit beyond that region, we're hearing many fighters from Chechnya are joining in. Is that the case?
Well, one of the fighters that was killed in this was Omar Sheshin. And this is a Chechen fighter who has led a big brigade, has been a right-hand man for the caliphate, and has gotten tons of news because he's very handsome. He's got a big red beard. And so he strikes this very appealing figure, and he's got a great sense of humor, and he laughs a lot, and so he has made many propaganda tapes for the Islamic State, and I think has attracted a lot of the foreign fighters. So his death was a big blow to it's certainly the public image of the Islamic State.
So unfortunately, this situation continues. Syria obviously is involved here, and this comes on top of the civil war, if we want to call it that, that's been happening in Syria for the last 3 years, and it just adds to the refugee situation that's been going on there. Since 2011, we're looking at over 3 million people that have been displaced, and reports came out this week by international watch groups that actually these people are more stuck than ever before, that the numbers that are being allowed to leave or countries that are taking these refugees in, they're actually cutting those numbers significantly.
They are, and there's some distressing news from places like Lebanon, for example, which has been so generous. Over 1 million Syrian refugees, a young kid of about 14 was killed by vigilantes, and others have been thrown out and taken by police and just dumped on the Syrian side of the borders. People we believe, activists who are being searched for by the government. So this could lead to their death. States are running out of patience. People are very angry. We've seen vigilantism in Turkey and in Jordan both, because all these countries, and particularly into smaller ones like Lebanon and Jordan, The economy is terrible. I know many people who've lost their jobs because Syrians are willing to do them for half the price. And you've got great engineers and many people, many professionals coming into the country looking for anything, any kind of work, and willing to do it for almost nothing. So it's put great strain on the host countries.
Anytime you have a significant movement of people, there's going to be tensions, and certainly the countries that are in the area. Are countries beyond the region taking these refugees in, or is that some way that we could perhaps help the situation?
Well, they aren't taking the refugees in. The United States has given refugee status to many Syrians who are present, who are in the country, but is trying not to give visas to Syrians. So are most European countries, because they know that once a Syrian gets into their country, they will demand refugee status, and it'll be almost impossible for local judges to deny it to them, because Syria is such a hellhole. 90% of Syrians live below the poverty line, and nobody in their right mind would send anyone back to Syria today.
So is there any silver lining here? What are the Syrians that are stuck in this situation to do? What are the neighboring countries that are having to deal with this?
The UN has just announced that they're going to work on a new plan for ceasefires around Aleppo, the big northern capital. There's meetings in Russia. There have been a flurry of attempts to get new strategies for trying to bring this to an end, but all of them seem very difficult. Even the White House has announced, President Obama announced that he was going to take a new look at Syrian strategy to see if – because our allies, the vetted militias that we're supposed to be partnering with, largely have been beaten up by the radicals. So everybody's scratching their head and trying to figure out some way to move forward on this in a positive way.
Well, thank you so much, Joshua, for enlightening us once again today.
Pleasure.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you may have. Leave a comment in the Worldviews section of KGOU.org or send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. We also have a link to Joshua Landis's widely read blog, Syria Comment, and you can follow him on Twitter at Joshua_Landis. Coming up next, we'll air Suzette Grelot's recent conversation with Mia Koto, an author and journalist from Mozambique who just won the 2014 Neustadt International Prize for Literature. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, in today for Suzette Grelot. Last month, author Mia Koto visited Norman to accept the 2014 Neustadt International Prize for Literature. He started his literary career during his native Mozambique's struggle for independence. When he was nominated for the award that's often compared to the Nobel Prize for Literature, he was called a, quote, smuggler writer, like a Robin Hood of words who steals meanings to make them available in every tongue, forcing apparently separate worlds to communicate. During his time in Norman, he visited the KGOU studios for a conversation with Suzette Grelot. Mia Koto, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start by looking first at your background. You were born and raised in Mozambique.
Yes.
But you started studying science. It looked to me like you were maybe going to become a doctor. You're studying medicine, biology.
Yeah.
But you became a writer instead.
Yeah, I was wrong. And those two different moments I was wrong. I was wrong thinking that I should be a doctor. I didn't become a doctor. I interrupted my studies, not because I wanted, but because at that time in 1972, I belonged to this liberation movement for the independence of Mozambique. And that's whose name is Frelimo until now. And Frelimo asked me, they don't ask me, they said to me that I should interrupt the studies. And go to a newspaper, try to infiltrate, that was the name, the newspaper. So I became a journalist, not because I wanted, but because I was said to do.
It was your assignment. You were assigned as a journalist.
That was my commitment. I did it with pleasure, let's say. I don't have any regret on changing my life the way it happens. But then I, as a journalist, I also interrupt because then I, in a certain moment, I come in a collision with that, you know, what was happening in our, let's say, revolution. I lost my trust. So I come back to the university again and I become a biologist. That's what I am. That's what I do as a profession.
So let's talk about your experience, though, during that revolution, during that independence movement. Mozambique, of course, was a Portuguese colony,
yes.
And won its independence and had then a brutal civil war. So tell us a little bit about that experience, what that was like, and then maybe we could get to how that then informed the work that you did later in life.
Yeah, that was really, we cannot describe the horror. It was 16 years where we were surrounded by, not just by the war, but what the kind of fear that is very ancient. We learned to suspect of the others, the all others. And I remember that during those years, there's nothing to buy in the shops. So the first thing that when we came out in the morning to work was, what should I bring to my house, to my children? And then at the same time, there was values. This is a very big contrast, because at the same time, some ethic values were still very present. And the way we were helping each other in the cities that are surrounded by the war was really something that I should say I missed that, because sometimes we think that the moral misery comes from the material misery, but it's not so linear.
So can you expand on that a little bit? I love what you just said, the moral misery coming from material misery, but that's not so.
Not always.
So yeah. Where is it coming from then?
I think there's a kind of a system. Look, in Mozambique, we don't have a word to say poverty. A poor person is called Shisiwana, which means orphan. So a poor person is someone that doesn't have that kind of system of relationships, social relationships, family, the friends, the neighborhood. So I think that's what is now lost. People don't trust. People don't have this kind of web relationships. And that's where then it comes to the situation where you should survive by your own, okay, without expecting nothing from the others.
Mozambican author and 2014 Newstat International Prize for Literature winner Mia Koto speaking with Suzette Grelot. We'll hear more of their conversation right after a short break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, we've been listening to a conversation with Mia Koto. He's the 2014 winner of the Newstat International Prize for Literature. When he accepted the award earlier this fall in Norman, he stopped by the KGOU studios for a conversation with Suzette Grelot.
So in your work, in your literary work, you tend to focus a lot on identity issues.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that relates to that experience that you've had and just this subject of trust that you were referring to, and the kind of moral and material dilemmas of life, but the search for identity and the construction of that identity. Tell us a little bit more about how that has influenced your actual written work.
Yeah. A lot. I thought in the beginning that was important to find real identities. I'm speaking in plural because Mozambique has such a big diversity of cultures and languages and religions. And I thought it was a quest for a writer to find that identity. Then I realized that it is always a false quest, because there's a lot of identities, it's a kind of utopic vision that we will never find that single identity. It's always, and it helps me very much to be a happy person, because I accept that I am a diverse person, and more than one identity, I have stories. And those stories gave me different points of view.
So it's so interesting how you're using this concept of identity not only as a personal construct, something that, you know, we're multiple people all at one time, right? We nest our identities. We perhaps identify with different things at different levels and depending on the role we're playing at any particular time, right?
Yeah,
a certain identity emerges. But that reflection of personal identity is also evident in national identity. I mean, you started out by saying Mozambique has multiple identities, or that it's a you know, it's a community, it's a country of many different kinds of people, backgrounds, histories, language. So how to manage all of that without having identity crisis, right? Not only personally, but in terms of your nation. I mean, that's what Mozambique has clearly struggled with over the years. And obviously we as individuals struggle with that over the years.
I think if we accept that we are so diverse and we do not impose one single identity, we have the password, let's say, to travel around these identities, different identities. And that way of traveling, that voyage is so important and so pleasure. We take such a pleasure while traveling throughout identities then we realize that what is important is the way and not the destiny. It's the trip, not the destiny.
I love the way you put that, traveling around different identities and how important that voyage is. Well, I think something else that you've emphasized in your work is the role of memory, or actually rather than memory, it's kind of the opposite. It's forgetfulness. Yeah. You've talked about in previous conversations the importance of forgetfulness and actually not even just random forgetfulness, but purposeful forgetfulness. Yeah. That in the case of Mozambique, for example, or any country or any society, any place that's struggling with recuperating from these kinds of conflicts, that you have to forget some things, and that you do it by choice, that you choose to forget what's happened in the past in order to move forward. And that's reflected in your writing and your characters.
Yeah. I think it's not just in that case in Mozambique or where you can find in very cruel wars, but nations are born from this forgetfulness, from this oblivion. And our history, our official history of our countries and our societies are made of forgetfulness. So I think it's a kind of to be conscious that we are deciding to forget. And of course, in Mozambique, that's a big decision because we're trying to forget everything that happens during that period. And I think there's a mixture between this is a wise decision. This is not really a decision. It was taken silently by everybody. And because those guys are conscient that, the tensions are still there. So it's a kind of a Pandora box. If they open it, it will come again, the war. But at the same time, we need to remember. We need to be able to remember. So I think literature can help on this kind of the way coming back, not to point fingers, not to to have a guilty position, but to be free to visit those recent times.
That's so being able to remember but not have that tension is obviously one of the world's greatest dilemmas. Yeah. And that's often because forgiveness isn't part of the picture. So when you talk about forgetfulness, that we forget what happens, and then there's the cost of not remembering what happens. But what if you work into that? This issue of forgiveness. You don't forget, maybe, but you forgive. And then that way you can remember and not have that tension and those lingering, issues that if you open that Pandora's box, there it is all over again. Is that, from your experience, we need to remember the forgiveness part?
You see, it's happening in Mozambique in a very underground situation. People are, those who have participated in the killings and the massacres, they have been chosen to have some kind of traditional therapy. So they act with traditional healers, with witch doctors, and the way they do it is like those religions that are still alive in Mozambique are more important than this monotheistic religions. So the concept of forgiveness should be related to these kind of values that are more present in this. And the way it works is that you are during these therapeutic sessions, let's say, you are considered that you were not you. You are not really yourself when you did that. Okay. So there's a kind of, really reinitiation of the person to be another.
So maybe on a related issue, you've also said much about women, the role of women in society, and clearly female characters have played a significant role in your work. But along these lines of forgetting, remembering, forgiveness in particular, I mean, you've said that women, that their role is so crucial in reshaping culture and society, and that their role in encouraging peace, yeah, you know, in particular in Mozambique after 16 years of war, you've said that women don't have a tribe, yeah, you know, meaning they kind of transcend these boundaries. The role of women are they critical to this process? And and really, perhaps, should we not be looking maybe to women to help us engage in this process of reconciliation?
Course. Yeah. No, of course. You see, I'm a writer because I became a writer in my kitchen when I was a child, because my mother and, you know, my aunts and friends were using that kitchen as a kind of a magic space. And while they were cooking, they are kind of that was a magical dance, and they were telling stories. And they're telling stories not in a loud voice. So I think I discovered the magic of, you know, listen and telling stories, and that's in that moment. And I think in Mozambique we have a very violent society, men against women, and I think men are afraid because they cannot deny that women are creating stories, so they want to take it out, the stories from that women, and so women can be reconstructing that time that is lost, the time of the war. Creating stories and telling stories about that period.
And reaching out across different societies within Mozambique, yeah, and within, I mean, in any society that's dealing with, reaching out to other locations.
I think they will create those bridges that are still missing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mia Koto, thank you so much for being here today. Congratulations once again. You've really given us some insight into a country that we don't often talk about around the world and is often forgotten in terms of its history and past. So thank you for sharing with us today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Suzette Gerlot's conversation with Mia Koto, an author from Mozambique who just received the 2014 Neustadt International Prize for Literature. He'll be featured in the January 2015 issue of the magazine World Literature Today. We have more information about this program on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our research fellow is Symphony Swift, Hallie Arias and Sarah Hurd prepare our web content, and Brian Hardzinski produces the show. For Joshua Landis and Suzette Gerlot, I'm Rebecca Cruz.